Okay, we're just coming up on 7:30, so I'm going to go ahead and, as usual, I'm going to mute all, and everybody will have the ability to unmute themselves. Feel free to do so if you have a comment or question, and remute yourself afterwards to keep background noise to a minimum. Later on this evening, somewhere, the contents of the deck tonight and the audio track and the chat window will go up on a website somewhere. We currently have a bit of a glitch going on with our service provider, and there's a chance that the Q&A stuff will not be able to be posted to its normal location. Alan will post to the member forum where that location is, if it's anywhere other than normal. And if you're not part of the forum, you can contact Alan directly. So once again, welcome to all to Q&A for this October 16th Q&A session. We have quite a few items on the agenda. Hopefully we will have time for the final 10 as well. But let's go ahead and kick it off, and Alan, take us through tonight's deck.
Okay, thank you, Chris, and welcome, as Chris said, to everyone. And last week was our 200th Q&A session. So tonight is 201, I guess. So thank you all for attending, and I hope you enjoy the evening. We're going to start off with a follow-up from a week or two ago, I think it was, and Chris is going to tell us about 2FA.
Yeah, so this came in from Elizabeth, and she had a little bit of an adventure with Simply Financial, and she noted that the where is the controls again, Alan, for me being able to advance the slides?
I didn't give it to you yet.
Oh, okay.
Okay, so okay. Right now.
It says he ended slide control. You.
There we go.
Okay, there we go. Okay. So, yeah, she mentioned that we had been talking about two-factor authentication before at Q&A, and it definitely is a good way to strengthen the resilience of any of your online accounts to attack. And then in the chat, there have been some mentions from some other Simply banking customers that they actually do get a 2FA code via text message whenever they log on to their bank account. And Elizabeth is saying, well, she never gets 2FA texts when she was banking with Simply. And there were a few times where she received a phone message from a computer animated voice speaking out the code that she could then type in. She didn't like this because usually have the volume up and everyone could hear the code being given out. Just as an aside, I don't think that that's a too big an issue in that unless somebody else has already managed to put in your username and password and is anxiously awaiting the code, they're not going to be able to circumvent your ability to log in. So today's problem, which actually goes back a few days, she was not able to get into her bank account, and she got presented with an option or button to say send code, and she clicked on it, but she didn't get either a phone message or a text message with the code. So she ended up calling Simply, and she got an explanation about it. So apparently they use some sort of algorithm to decide who's getting authenticated with two-factor authentication. And you might not get that request for two-factor authentication if you're using the same device or if your usage doesn't deviate from your usual pattern, same location and things like that. And apparently they do mix it up some, randomly picking customers and circumstances for those who will actually get the two-factor authentication requirement. So the problem was, it turned out, that her cell phone number was recorded with Simply as being the home number. And she always had a cell phone, but it was put in as home number, and the box for cell number had been left empty. So Simply decided to send two-factor authentications via text rather than phoning, and the code wasn't sent because home number was assumed to be a landline, which, of course, would not be able to accept text messages. So the solution was simply updated the cell box with her phone number, updated the contact preferences to SMS, so getting text messages for that. And in the future, if Simply decides to send a code, it should come in via SMS text message. And she's thinking that in the future, she's probably going to ask them to make it mandatory with every login so that she has that two-factor authentication always in place. And so Elizabeth is on the call. Elizabeth, do you want to add anything to that?
I just say that Simply seems to be different than some other banks, I guess, because sometimes they verify with 2FA and sometimes they don't.
All banks seem to be different. It's a bugaboo I have with, or complaint I have with Alterna, is they have no two-factor authentication, period. And the way that I have decided to deal with that is that one of the notification options at Alterna is that if you successfully log in, it will send you an email. And so every time I log in, I get an email saying a successful login happened. So if I ever get one of those where it wasn't me logging in, I'd immediately call Alterna. But I haven't actually asked them why they don't have 2FA. But it looks like every bank has their own little wrinkles to things, I guess.
I might add that last time we talked about this, there are other people who use Simply, and they always get 2FA. So they somehow they're flagged on the system to always ask for 2FA.
Yeah, very weird. Oh, well. Okay, so that's it for that one.
It depends if you're always logging in from your from the same IP address, then they may not ask for 2FA. So if someone hacks your bank account, then they may not get in. But on the other hand, if they hack your home computer, they will.
But it would be a little unusual for some people to always get 2FA requests, because you would think that in most circumstances, your IP address is not going to be changing. Your location is not going to be changing. So, you know, you would think that that would not be flagged for 2FA. So who knows how they've decided that certain people get it all the time.
It depends. If you're accessing from your phone, then your IP will change depending on whether you're home or not, whether you're using the phone company and who knows what IP they assign you versus your home, where it usually stays much the same.
Mm. Yeah, it could be.
Okay, so thanks for that, Chris. And Elizabeth Kwong, we had a question that was posted in the user forum, I think it was. And Carol Ann was looking for an easy way to sort all the photos that were present on the computer. And because she has photos under several folders, and she believes that there are multiple copies there, so she's looking for an easy way to sort them. And then Karen followed up with that and said, well, wouldn't it be nice if we could do that for all file types and not just photos? So Chris came back and said that there's no easy button. But you have some duplicate file finders, Chris.
Yeah, so CCleaner is one that I use. And CCleaner has, under their tools menu, they have duplicate file finder. And it's pretty good in that you can specify how it will determine whether files are duplicate. You could do it just by file name. You could add in any of these are additives, so you can do one or more of these. You could do it by the file size, the modified date, and you can even do an exact byte-for-byte content match. However, be aware that if you do that, you're going to be really, really slow, because it's going to have to actually calculate a hash of absolutely every file and compare those hashes. But that's one that I have used, and it seems to work pretty well. Search My Files is another one. It can't look for exact content, but you can limit by various attributes and so forth, and that's available. These are all free of charge. You can get these. And then there's another one that, there we go, Awesome Duplicate Photo Finder. And this is kind of interesting in that they claim that they're able to compare photos that are not identical. So if they're resized or colors were changed and so forth, they can still detect that it's actually a duplicate file. I don't know how much things can change. I've never actually used this, but it's the only one that I came across where it could actually look to edited files and determine that they may be the same photo, just one of them being edited. So those are three that I've come across, and Alan will take us through a little bit of a different approach.
Yeah, I was wondering whether there was a way to do this. I noticed Tom's mentioned a program called Everything, which is a search routine. And sure enough, it will list like star.jpegs and that kind of thing. But I was wondering about whether it was possible to do it with some kind of command. So as it happens, on my Windows box, this icon showed up recently on the taskbar. And when you hover over it, it turns out it loads Microsoft Copilot, which is Microsoft's chatbot. And basically, since they put all kinds of money into OpenAI, I imagine it's a spin-off from ChatGPT or something like that. Anyway, it was sitting there, so I decided I would ask it, how can I sort all the JPEG files on my computer into a single list? And it gave me a couple of false starts. It gave me some code which didn't work because the operating system denied access to the system volume information folder. But I kept feeding the error messages back, and eventually it gave me a set of PowerShell commands that would do what I asked. So here's the final version. Notice it says, "Ugh, access denied errors are a real nuisance." Let's run PowerShell as an administrator and do things. And so here's the various commands. It's looking for C colon your path. So I just changed that to D colon backslash, which is my dedicated data drive. And then down here, it's filtering for star.jpeg. So it's only going to look for JPEG files. And you notice here, if you're trying to use these commands off this slide, there's a piece missing here because it's scrolls off the end of the screen here. So if you want to use this technique, you need to run this same query in a chatbot and get the full code. And you can't get it off this particular slide. But when you run those commands, and sure enough, you get a list of a whole bunch of JPEGs. And if you remember my presentation about Google Sites, you'll remember I had some Texas JPEGs. And my brother-in-law will be happy to know I've got the Swinging Impalas, his group from the 60s, I guess. And then there's some Iceland pictures here and a whole bunch of stuff. And if you look through there, you'll find Texas and the and Thunderbird. And so they're kind of in alphabetical order. So that kind of thing will help you, and clearly you can modify that for any kind of file type. Okay, moving along.
Just before we go on, Bill asked, you need to use an MS account, log in to use Copilot. Tom says no.
And I say you actually need a 365 account. That's what Copilot told me.
Oh, okay.
Tom, you're muted.
I suspect that it really is just any Microsoft account would actually work.
Copilot lies. I don't run with a Microsoft account usually, and I can access Copilot from my search bar or from Microsoft Edge without a problem.
Oh, so it's good hallucination. I like that.
Yeah. Okay. That's all the questions
we
have.
Sorry?
That's all the questions we had. So.
Okay. Yeah, next up we have Chris. This is Chris from a while ago. Chris can't live without Microsoft Power Toys. And tonight I think he's got a brand new one to tell us about.
This is actually not a new one, but it's one of the more useful ones that I've come across, and so I thought I would go through it. So just as a recap on it, the Microsoft PowerToys, it's a collection of free utilities. You have to install the entire batch of them. You don't have to use them. You can actually turn any of them off that you don't want to actually use. And in actual fact, a couple of them are disabled by default, and you have to turn them on if you want to use them, but you have to install the entire package. So it is designed to enhance productivity and customization, and it'll work in any Windows 10 or Windows 11 computer. It was actually started by some programmers at Microsoft in their spare time, and it got open sourced. And so now many of the contributors are actually from outside of Microsoft proper, and anybody can actually contribute to the project, either with code, translations, reporting errors, and so forth. I've reported a number of errors over the years, and by and large, they've been addressed pretty well. So to install it, you can do it from the Microsoft Store, which is the easiest way. So if you go to the Microsoft Store app, and then you search for Microsoft PowerToys, and it'll come up as the first hit, and you go ahead and install it. If you want a little bit more control or whatever, you can actually install it from GitHub, which is the repository where it's maintained, and the URL is there, and I will paste this into the chat. Actually, I forgot to paste the other ones, so there's one, the photo finders, and then for the PowerToys install, I'm pasting that in. So if you go to the GitHub, you do get a little bit more control in that you can actually decide whether you want it installed on a per-user basis so that only the current user would have access to it, or you want it machine-wide so that any account on the computer would have access to the PowerToys. And you can also install a ARM64 version of the PowerToys as well. If you go from Microsoft Store, you'll just get standard 64-bit install, bang, for Windows, and that's it. Also Intel. So once they're installed, then you can go in and you can make sure the PowerToys run is enabled, which is what I'm going to be talking about today. It's a really powerful utility. So it allows you to search for and open up programs that are on your computer, search for and open documents that are on your computer. It does use Windows Search to find documents, and it does not look for the contents of documents. Some of the PowerToy users at the repository at GitHub have suggested integrating everything into it because it is extensible, and so it would be possible for somebody to write some kind of integration so that it could use everything to actually do the searching. And it can do a whole bunch of different things, including calculations, unit conversions. It can search the web. It can search in Windows settings, and there's more. So the default keystroke to open up PowerToys Run is Alt and the space bar. And a lot of people might know that that is actually usually the control menu for most open apps is Alt spacebar. So you lose that capability to do that. If you actually use Alt spacebar for something else, like opening up the top left-hand menu in program windows, you can actually redefine the hotkey for PowerToys Run to something else. All of the PowerToys, they come with a default keystroke to do it, but you can feel free to redefine any of them. And when you hit the Alt space, you'll get this dialog box pop up into the middle of the screen. And it just says start typing, but then it gives you hints down below as to what you can actually do as a prefix on it to force it to give you a certain type of run. So if you just start typing in a name, so it will look for programs and files that will actually match that on your computer. So here I've typed in photo, and it's actually grayed out, but the S is there, so you can just hit tab to move beyond what it thinks might be what you're going for. But at the photo, it actually found three installed programs. So the photos, and they say packaged application, that means a Windows Store app. Photoscape X, which is also a Windows Store app. And then OnOneFoto Raw Max 2024, which is my main photo editing program. So it very quickly found three programs that would match that photo. Next thing it does, which I found really, really bizarre, is it gives you an https://, and whatever it is you typed in, slash. And so it's thinking, oh, maybe you mean a website that is just called photo. No .com or .org or anything like that. I found that pretty bizarre that they would actually offer that as an option. You could search the web. So you could click on that, and it would search the web for the word photo. You have a running program, so it will search for any running programs that will match it as well. So when I hit that alt space, I actually had my photo editor running on the computer. So on OneFoto Raw Max 2024 came up as an option, and if I clicked on that, it would just switch to that instance of the running program. The next thing I found was really iffy. It found a draft email with the word photo in it. Now, what's really bizarre about it is that I have lots and lots of emails that include the word photo, including a couple of other email programs, and other searches that I did not come up with Gmail. So I don't know what that one is. To me, it's not reliable at all. And then it came up with a bunch of documents and folders that had the word photo in it. So very quickly, when you just type in something, it can find those things for you, and you just click on them, and they will load that program or that document into the associated application. So very handy for that. You can also do calculations. So if you put in the equal sign, if I just go back one, you'll see in the left-hand panel, equals is the first one there. So if you do equals, it calculates a mathematical equation, and they give you EG. You know, 5 times 3 minus 2. So you can type in equals and then type in whatever it is you want to calculate. And there's a great number of operators that you can actually have it do. You know, factorials, the sine, pi, sine, cosines, and all the rest of it. And then as you type it in, as soon as it thinks that it's got an answer for that portion of it, it will actually put it into the just below where you're typing in. And if you just click on that, it'll actually copy that number to the clipboard. And it gives it to 10 points of precision on it, so pretty cool. And then unit conversions. So the percent will start a unit conversion. So in this case here, I said 2.3 miles in kilometers. It gave me the answer, and I could click on that to copy that result to the clipboard. And you can see the supported conversions on there. There's a lot that are available. Acceleration, mass, power, pressure, speed, so forth. So there's a lot of different conversions that you can actually do in here. And they also support plugins. So other people can write additional plugins that will show up extras. So they are created by third parties. They do extend the capabilities of the PowerToys run. And within the PowerToys setup or configuration dialog box, you go to PowerToys Run, there's actually a link there where you can go to the plugins that are available. And I'm going to highlight two of them, a currency converter and ChatGPT. So the currency conversion plugin, once you install it, there are over 200 currencies supported, and it's the $$. So you put in $$, and then it knows that you want to actually do a currency conversion. So you can fully specify both currencies. So here I did CAD, which is their abbreviation for Canadian dollar, 235.56 to USD or US dollars, and it came up with the answer there. You can also configure for quick conversions. So if you want, you can go in, and this is in the dialog box for configuring PowerToys Run. And so you can say you want other currencies to the local currency or local currency to other currencies. You set in what your base currency is. So in this case, I said Canadian dollars. And then I want quick conversions to and from U.S. dollar, British pound, and the euro. And then when I come in and I do $$, and just an amount, it knows that I can do a quick conversion, and it knows what I want to convert to and from. And it will give me both directions. So it'll give me the Canadian dollar as the base, but it can be 203.12 from the various foreign currencies, U.S. dollar, British pound, and the euro to Canadian dollars, or it can give me as well. It'll give me the 203.12 in Canadian, converting that to the other currencies that you put in. And I don't know if there's any limit to the number of currencies that you can actually put in. I wouldn't want to have a list of 200, but was no problem having three like that. So quite useful on that. And then there's the ChatGPT plugin. So I put that in, and you can see that then it comes up as GPT as a prefix. And if I type in GPT and then whatever I want to ask ChatGPT, so I said free activities for tourists visiting Ottawa, Canada for 2 days, and then I click on the results, and it actually comes up with, in ChatGPT parlance, what they think would be good activities for 2 days. It's no different than going to ChatGPT. It's just that you can do it right from the PowerToys run rather than going to your browser and loading up ChatGPT. And I think that's it. So were there any questions on that?
Jocelyn says he finds Google good for all kinds of conversions, including those mentioned, and also calculations.
Now, there's nothing that this is doing that is not possible other ways. It's just that I find it really, really handy to just hit Alt Space, and I can do it right from the main screen on my computer.
Okay, that's it, Chris. And the next slide goes to, I believe.
Okay. Okay, I guess this is me too. So this is a real quickie on this for file transfer between a phone and a desktop. We've talked about this before, and I just have this one slide I came across, and I'll paste this into the chat as soon as I'm done talking. So we've talked before about doing file transfers between a phone and a desktop, and I did a bit of a spiel on LocalSend, and the URL is there for that. But I came across a Computer World article on 8 easy ways to transfer files between Windows and your phone, including LocalSend. So if you're interested in doing that and you don't like LocalSend, or you just want to check out what other options you have available to you, check out that URL, and you can find some other ones. And that's it.
Okay. Thanks, Chris. Okay, so next up, I've got part 2 here on my Trading Up to Linux series, and just to remind everybody, we're in the middle of October, and in 1 year's time, on October the 14th, Windows 10 reaches its end of life, so there will be no further security patches. And some people, like me, I have 3 computers on the go right now, and none of them have an upgrade path to Windows 11. So my philosophy, or my plan, is to dual boot everything into Linux and Windows, disable the network capability or the internet capability for Windows, and run. I have one program that won't run under Linux, and I have PowerPoint isn't very compatible with Linux. So when I need to run those two programs, I will run those on the Windows side of the house. And for the rest of the time, as usual, which is I'm running Linux most of the time these days, I'll use the Linux box. Now, if you're interested in this process, Chris Barnett from Explaining Computers, this week's video on YouTube is basically exactly this. It's his perspective on what can you do with 1 year to go, when Windows 10 runs out to end of life. And a lot of it kind of echoes what I said last time. But one of the interesting things that I didn't appreciate was that Microsoft has a couple of web pages somewhere that say that there will be a paid-for extension period, a 3-year extension, which you will pay for, to give you security updates on Windows 10. And right now, there's no pricing been announced for that. One imagines that it's going to be somewhere between the educational pricing, which is for 3 years, it's basically $1, then $2, and then $4, which is really cheap. But if you're an enterprise customer, it's $61, $122, and then $244. So, several hundred dollars over the course of 3 years for an enterprise per machine. So presumably regular users are going to get something in between that maybe, but that's yet to be determined. So anyway, this is a really good video on all the pros and cons of what you can do with Windows 10. And then if you have any interest at all in switching up to Linux, this video is actually quite good in terms of being a Windows user and moving to Linux and some of the things that are similar and some of the things which are quite different between the two operating systems. Anyway, here's the basic plan. We'll have more as we go along. First thing to do is we're going to download Linux Mint, create a live USB, and then check that the hardware of our computer is compatible with Linux just by running it from the live USB and not actually touching the hard drive at all. And then if that works, if everything's fine and dandy, we can take a look at the bundled applications which come with Linux. And that will decide whether this is a good option for us or not. And then in the second phase, we'll move into that process where we actually install Linux on the hard drive in a dual boot mode. So we'll have two partitions, one with Windows, one with Linux, and we'll be able to boot between the two by using a boot menu. So that's the kind of basic plan to start with at least. And tonight we're just going to look at the first little bit where how do we create the live USB and how we're going to run it. And even if you're not interested in running Linux as a full-blown operating system because you can't upgrade to Windows 11, if you have any interest at all in Linux, this is a way to try Linux without doing anything except loading software onto a USB and running it from the USB. It doesn't do anything to your install version of Windows, for example. So in the October issue of the newsletter, there was an article, my article, Trading Up to Linux, was part one, basically went into a kind of an overview of how you do this, some details, I guess. If you need more information than that, then there's a full-blown how-to guide on my blog, my Linux North blog, and this has screenshots every step of the way in terms of what you need to do to create a live USB and run it on your computer. So that should really be a follow the bouncing ball technique. It should be very easy to follow. There are four things that you need. You need Linux Mint as an ISO file. And we're going to use the latest version, which is 22, which is codenamed Wilma. You need a USB flash drive, and it has to be at least 4 gigabytes. It can best to be empty, but if you have files on it, they will be overwritten. So take that into account. Don't leave files on there that you really need. You need some kind of software to burn the ISO to the flash drive. We're going to use Balina Etcher. And you also need, if you're going to use a USB, then you need to know how to boot your computer from a USB. And the easy way to do that is to just search for Google, boot Dell Inspiron from a USB, and it will tell you the keystroke to do that with. We can download the Linux Mint ISO file from linuxmint.com, which is the main Mint website. You hit the download button on the homepage, go to the next page and then scroll down and you'll find a bunch of mirrors, and there's a couple of Canadian ones there. I typically use the first one, the Manitoba Unix user group, and seems very reliable in terms of serving up the current versions of all the software. So if you choose one of the mirrors, then it tells you that you can download the ISO, and I've chosen the 64-bit Cinnamon edition, the Cinnamon desktop, mainly because that's very like Windows 10. Once you have the ISO file and you've downloaded Boolean Etcher, and you just need to download the file because it's a portable file, so you download the .exe file and you just run it directly from the download. Then it's a three-step process, and you choose the ISO file that you want to flash. You select the USB that you're going to burn this ISO file to, and then you basically hit the flash button, and the software will do its magic and create a live USB. And if you don't have a USB, then you can do this on a bootable CD or a DVD, and there are instructions for that on my Linux blog too. But I think most people these days will be able to boot from a USB. And the advantage of that is you can reuse the USB later if you decide you really don't want to run Linux. So how do you do it? So as I said, you just ask Google, how do I boot a Dell Inspiron 15 from USB? And it says, press F12 and you'll get a boot menu. And sure enough, that's exactly what happens. It says, boot from the hard drive, boot from the USB. Choose boot from the USB, and you will see your first Linux-type menu. And this is a grub menu, the Grand Unified Bootloader menu. And what we want is the first option there to start Linux Mint 22 from the USB. So be patient, because the boot process here is going to take a while. Remember, we're booting directly from the USB, not the computer's hard drive, and the USB is relatively slow. You see a bunch of black screens. Occasionally, this green and white Mint logo shows up. But eventually, after a few minutes probably, the Linux desktop will load, and as I say, in all its splendor. And here it is in all its splendor. Pretty basic type desktop, but it's serviceable, and we'll find out later on how to make this work quite well. But in the meantime, when you're booting up, you may have missed, or you may see this window pop up briefly, and it says something about connecting to Wi-Fi networks, and then it disappears. And of course, you'd really like to connect to your Wi-Fi network. So what you need to do is look along the bottom edge of the screen, which you would think is the Windows taskbar, but in Linux, they call it the panel. So in the lower panel, on the right-hand side, there's a bunch of icons, and this one with the kind of two arrows is the networking icon. And if you click on that networking icon, then it will pop up a dialog box, and you will be able to select from a list of available Wi-Fis. All my neighbors must have been asleep when I did this, because the only one that's available is Duck Pond, which is my Wi-Fi network. So when you click on that, you get this authentication pops up, and you have to give it the password for your Wi-Fi router. And then it will say briefly that your connection is now established. So now we have internet access. We can go back to the home page. This time we're going to look on the left-hand edge of the panel, and that bright orange icon with the little fox there is the Firefox web browser. If we click on that and we type in opcug.ca, then it will load the website, and here you are. You're browsing the internet using Linux. Instantly done, very simple. If you want to go further, we'll come back to this probably next week. The very far left-hand corner at the bottom of the screen is the Linux Mint logo, and that will load the main menu. And you can see here there's a whole bunch of categories of different software, and if you choose a category, then on the right-hand side, it lists all of the available programs that you can run. And remember, you're running on a live USB, so you can't destroy anything other than the software on the USB. So you're allowed to play around to your heart's content. Or you can wait until we talk about the contents of the Linux distro probably next week. In the meantime, there was a question last time we talked about Linux, and it was, if you decide you want to use Linux, can you run Microsoft Excel? And I said, yes, you can. Sometimes it will work really well. But here's my Linux desktop, and you'll notice that on the bottom corner there, there's a program starting to raise its ugly head, and that is, in fact, Microsoft Excel. And you notice here I've got column, and that's the addition of that column. Here I've got squares, and sure enough, this is this number right here is equal B4 squared, so it's 3 squared, which is 9, and again, I've got a total. So it's a live spreadsheet, a working version of Microsoft Excel. So it works really well. Except sometimes programs don't run very well. So that's something else we're going to talk about later on. So next time, we've just covered off downloading Mint and creating and using a USB. Next time, we're actually going to take a more detailed look at what's available in the distro in order to decide whether it's going to be of use to us or not. Okay, now I notice there's at least one question here.
Yep. Yeah, we got Elizabeth said might end up helping relatives move to Linux. Wondering about Mint. How long can I expect Mint to last?
Mint's on a 5-year cycle, so it's good now. And I think the current one, if it came out this year, 24, it should be good to 29, I think. And they've been building this thing for years and years. So every time they release a new long-term support version way before the old long-term support version disappears. So it's good forever, essentially.
Okay. And Jose said, is it necessary to create a disk partition before installing Linux for dual boot, or is it automatic?
You have to create it. You do need a second partition to install Linux on your hard drive. And if you want to run as dual boot, you need to leave the Windows position where it is, basically squeeze it, shrink it so it's smaller, create some unallocated space, and use that unallocated space for the installation of Linux. The good news is the installer will do that pretty well automatically for you, and we'll see that in a later segment in this series.
Okay, and Tom says, what about 2054? Is that another Unix time rollover date or something, Tom?
You're muted, Tom.
No, it's the title of a novel I just read.
Oh, okay.
I'm sure Linux is going to be running in 2054. I doubt that's going to be a problem.
I'm just looking ahead, you know. I never know.
Good for you.
Okay.
All right, we'll come back to Linux later on. But in the meantime, Chris has got a segment on visual ping.
Yeah, so this was interesting. As I was working my way through putting the slides together, things were looking less and less ideal, but I had done so much work on it, I decided to continue on anyways. The idea behind visual ping is if you frequently are checking websites for new material, so it's a blog or whatever kind of site, and you want to find out when there's new material that's been posted to it, and do you find it tedious to just always be going manually checking the site, say, oh, no changes, and you come back hours or days later and check, and oh, no, nothing new, and so forth. So is there a better way to go about doing that? So you can let Visual Ping monitor your websites for changes. So for free, you can have it monitor up to 5 different web pages, and the maximum frequency that you can choose is once a day. And if you have a paid account, and I'll talk more about the costs later on, paid accounts, you can monitor up to 100 pages, depending on the level of account you get, and the maximum frequency of every 2 minutes. So you can really be keeping on top of changes if you really want to. So when you go to Visual Ping and you sign in, and basically you don't have to create an account, but because you get notifications by email, that's all they really need to know. So you basically give them an email address that they'll send updates to, and that's all they want. Then it'll come up with the configuration screen on what it is you want to monitor. And so you type in the URL that you want to monitor. In this case here, I did CNET Tech Tips. And the next thing is you get the page will appear below where you put in the URL. You can monitor the entire page for changes, or you can use resize handles to actually select a portion of the page to monitor. So in this case here, I just selected the box that says the latest at CNET and decided I wanted to just check for when there's changes to that. So then you have the frequency of checking, and again, on free, every day, once a day is the most frequent you can do it, but you can check for weekly, every 2 weeks, or monthly if you want less frequent checks. Then you have a threshold on what will trigger an alert. So you can have it any change at all, or you can have it tiny, where it's like 1% of the content that you're monitoring is changing through medium, major, or gigantic. Then you have a compare type of visual versus text. And I'll come back to this, but right now I'm going to do it as a visual check, which is actually the default. So you will get an email when a change has been detected. And so here's an email I got from Visual Ping, and it says difference detected on CNET tech tips. And below that you see the page. Now, you see the very faint pink in the background of the text below each of the pictures. That's where it's detecting there was something different on that. So you get a summary at the top, which is actually a pretty good summary. So in this case here, it said there were new articles, and it said what the new articles were about, and it said two articles that dropped off the list, and it said what those articles were about. That summary is actually not bad. But what's not great is that you get this red overlay that shows the changes, and it looks there as if everything has changed on the page. And from a visual point of view, it really did, because everything moved around on that the latest section. But it really is just a matter of that you had, you know, just moved position for everything except for four of those little pictures. And so this is what really happened. You had two articles that got added, and you had two articles that fell off the list. Everything else was really the same, but from a visual point of view, they did move around. So Visual Ping decided that, well, it really is a change. So if you go instead to compare type of text, so I went and said, okay, how about I monitor for when new events get posted at the OPC UG website? So I go in and I choose that URL to monitor, so that's our homepage. Now if I'm in text mode, which I selected there, I can't actually select partial page. In text compare, you're comparing the entire page. And then I got an email about changes detected. And again, it was really confusing how it actually looked. The summary was actually good, but after that, it was not so great. So green is new material and red is removed material. And you can see it just a hodgepodge of things. So really hard to decipher that. So what it should have shown is that the Q&A session was removed from the top and a new item added at the end of the list. So instead, we got this interlaced mishmash, 201 changes that were detected on the page. Now, there weren't really 201 changes, but that's the way that it interpreted it. Now, down at the bottom, you have the snapshot, which shows the current versus the previous. Well, in this case here, I mean, it wasn't showing any of the changes because it only picked up at the top of the page and only had room for the banner photo, and there was no change. That was kind of useless. So in the email, down at the bottom, there is an option there you can choose called View Changes. And this actually gets a little bit more useful. So first off, it'll come up. It'll go off to the website for Visual Ping. And again, it shows this mishmash of things, which was not terribly helpful. The summary of changes was good, but that green for new material and red for removed material was not so great. However, I saw at the top of it, there was an option there. It says you've launched a new way to visualize changes. Do you prefer to visualize the old way? So I clicked on that, and this was a much cleaner way of showing the changes. So I zoomed way out so you could actually see the whole home page, and you can see how at the top there's the red for material that got taken off, and then green at the bottom for new material on the page. So this was actually a little bit more useful. Okay, so the plans on that, if you want to pay for it to get additional capabilities, the paid plan, it's not cheap. So it starts at $120 US a year. I think most of the people, the free account is perfectly good. 150 checks per month, 5 pages daily is a maximum frequency. That's probably, if you're using it, what most people would actually be happy with. So in summary, I find that the compare by text is more useful than visual. The email alerts I found always to be confusing. So I use the view changes in the email followed by visualize the old way for a little bit better way of seeing it. But quite frankly, I would just look at it as saying, oh, there is a change to the web page, and I would just go to the web page and read it and figure out what's actually changed myself. There is a comprehensive help guide that's available. There are some advanced features that are kind of neat, so you can actually track changes in a URL that is pointing to a PDF file, so it can look in PDF files for changes. It can track when a keyword is added or removed from a site, and these are keywords that you come up with. So you can say, well, is there a word new added to the website, or you know, whatever you want to trigger on, that you can see when that's been added or removed from the site. And there's an option to block ads and cookie banners so that they don't trigger a change detection on it. And I think that's it. So if we have any questions on that.
I didn't see anything, Chris.
Okay.
Just one thing that might serve as an alternative, although it's not exact, is that you can set up alerts in Google, which basically tells you if there's a new search that has revealed anything. So if you're looking for something that's new on any site, then you can use alerts.google.com.
Oh, cool. Thanks, Sam.
Okay, I didn't see any other questions in the chat window yet. So let's move along and remind you that we're always interested in apps and programs for Android and also for the PC, Windows programs, for example. And we do get one from Bill Bradwin. So if you have a Android device and you need to be able to print, this app called NocoPrint will basically allow you to do that. And it basically will deal with photographs and digital images and office files, PDF files, websites, and just about anything you can print, color or black and white. It will do duplex. And it will print multiple images per sheet, and it basically prints over Wi-Fi or Bluetooth, or you can connect it with a cable, a USB on-the-go cable, directly between your Android device and your printer. And so if you need to print from an Android device, then that's an app which will allow you to do that. So thanks, Bill, for that. And next up, we have a question from the boss.
This is a call to action. So it's a program called Music Brains Picard, and I'm going to paste this into the chat. So it's a cross-platform, so it's available for Mac, Windows, and Linux. It's free and open source, and it's a music tagger. So it got recommended by Graham Cluley. I watch his weekly podcast on Smashing Security. And I don't know why I would in particular give him any weight of being good at reviewing a music app for when he's on a security podcast. But he seems to be a sensible sort of character. So I decided to pass it on. So it does support all the popular music formats. And it uses an open source, community maintained database of music called Music Brains. provides accurate information about millions of music releases, and it can tag for your album, track name, artist, record label, year of issue, all kinds of details that it can tag your MP3 or any of your audio files. Can also optionally use Acoustic ID, where it will actually fingerprint the audio of an actual song and compare that to what they know. And it can actually identify files by the actual music, even if there's no metadata available in it at all, and even if the name of the song, everything is not there, it can actually identify it by the actual song. It can look up entire music CDs with a single click, and it can find and download cover art for your albums as well. So I'm not interested myself, but if anybody out there is interested in it, maybe interested in checking it out and seeing if it's worth doing a share on it, I've pasted the URL into the chat window. And so if anybody's interested in actually doing that, let us know, and we'll reserve a spot for you at a future Q&A where you can let us know if it's any good.
Okay, thanks, Chris. And we're now in that last 10-minute period where we invite other questions. I don't think we've missed anything in the chat window, but if anybody's put a question in there that Chris and I didn't notice, now's the time to bring it to our attention. If you have any other questions, then, again, just either put something in the chat right now, or you're allowed to open your mic and basically ask the question directly. I notice that Tom has put in a free and open source software program called MP3 Tag, which is at least as part of the job of that Music Brains that Chris was talking about in terms of tagging audio files. Okay, well, nothing's forthcoming, so let's move along. If anybody has any burning questions, you can still put it in the chat window. As Chris mentioned up front, we have a little problem right now with our web host service, and I'm not sure that I'm going to be able to update the Q&A page as usual. I will be able to post the file somewhere on the internet, and I will let people know. If you're a member of the OPCUG, then if you're subscribed to the members forum, I always put a message in after the meeting telling you that these files are available. So pay attention to tonight, because it may say that they're available somewhere else. Now, as Chris said, if you're not a member of the PC user group, but you do want to see these files, and they do get posted somewhere other than normal, just send me an email, and I'll be happy to tell you where they are or forward you the files. Okay, so we're just about up to the witching hour, and so I'll remind you that next week will be our next Q&A, October the 23rd, and as usual, if you have questions or follow-ups on the things we've talked about tonight, excuse me, or if you have topics that you'd like to share, like a review of Music Brains or whatever it was called, then just send us a few details to the suggestion box, and we'll be happy to add you to the agenda. So we've had a pretty broad-ranging set of topics tonight. Hope everybody enjoyed it. You found it useful and informative, and I'll see you next week.
Thanks for coming, folks. See you next Wednesday.